We're up to Parshat Pinchas. We left off last week in suspense. Pinchas had limped over to the tent of Zimri ben Salu, the head of the tribe of Shimon, and everyone thought he was in on it. He was also interested in sinning. And then Pinchas took out the flint, he took out the knife and attached it to his cane, and he thrust it through the tent, and he pierced Zimri and Kozbi and picked them up like a shish kebab, right? Picked them up on the spear, and everyone saw him. And then the tribe of Shimon started saying, "Who does he think he is?" And he stood there in danger of the tribe of Shimon. Now, as this is happening, people are dropping like flies. 24,000 people drop dead. All around them, people are dropping dead. And Hashem tells Moshe, tell the Jews that Pinchas shouldn't be mocked. People were saying, Pinchas' grandfather was a pagan. Pinchas' grandfather, his great-grandfather, Elazar married from the daughters of Jethro, Pinchas' father. So his grandfather was Jethro, Yisro. So they said, who does he think he is? His grandfather was a pagan. He's not even one of ours. And he killed the leader of the tribe. And Hashem said, go tell them he's the grandson of Aaron. He has another grandfather. What are they doing mocking his grandfather? His grandfather was also Aaron. And thanks to him, the plague stopped. So he is given a covenant of peace. We have a tradition that the word peace, shalom, is written differently over here in the Torah. It's called a vav ketua. Either there's a break in the letter vav or it's a small vav. Two traditions on how we write that vav. Maybe we'll still get back to that. And he is now given the gift of being not only a kohen, but ultimately kohuna gedola. The high priest will come for Pinchas because he avenged my anger. And the Torah then says, take revenge from the Midianites. Look at what they did to you. You should maintain an enmity towards them for what they did to you. They caused you to sin. They sent their daughters to cause you to sin. And then Hashem tells Moshe and Aaron, I want you to count the Jewish people, and each tribe is counted. We finished the count. We're up to Shlishi. And the Jews number 601,730. And then Hashem says, the people you just counted, that, well, now you're going to divide the land of Israel between the tribes, divided amongst the families. And then the daughters of Tzlafchat come forward. And they say, our father was a firstborn, and when we inherit his portion, we have no brothers. Do we also inherit his double portion in the land of Israel? And Moshe forgets the answer. He asks Hashem, and Hashem says, they're right. And then we have the laws of inheritance. Hashem tells Moshe, I want you to climb the mountain Har HaAvarim, and I want you to look at the land, and after that you'll pass away. And Moshe asks Hashem to appoint a leader who will take his place. And Hashem says, appoint Yeshua, who is faithful to you, and everyone should see how you appoint him, and he will ask the Kohen Gadol the questions, and Moshe appoints Yeshua in his stead. And we're up to Chamishi. And with that, we come to the final part of the Parsha, which discusses the sacrifices, the Tamid sacrifice that's brought twice every day of the year, the Shabbos sacrifice that's added to sheep, which is called Musaf, it's the added sacrifice for Shabbos, the sacrifices of Rosh Chodesh, and the sacrifices of each holiday. And that brings us to the conclusion of the Parsha, the sacrifices of the holidays. Okay, so now let's review the Parsha and see a bit more what's going on here. We have a halacha, says in Prophets, in the book of Isaiah, in Yeshaya, uvefarischem kapechem. We will read that prophecy of Isaiah in 3 weeks. and Shabbat Chazon, that is the difficult prophecy of Chazon Yeshayahu ben Amoz, the first prophecy in the book of Isaiah, and it is the final prophecy we read before Tisha B'Av. Starting this week, now after Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, we have three Shabbatot leading up to Tisha B'Av, and on those 3 weeks we have a tradition that's a pretty new tradition. It's only about 2 millennium old. It's only 2,000 years we're doing this. It's not recorded in the Talmud or in the Mishnah, but shortly thereafter they started this custom of reading three prophecies about destruction. This week and next week will be from the book of Jeremiah. And then the final Shabbat leading up to Tisha B'Av is called Shabbat Chazon, because the prophecy we read is the first prophecy of Isaiah, which begins with the word Chazon. Chazon Yeshayahu ben Amoz. And the term Chazon is one of 10 terms of prophecy. We have 10 words to introduce prophecy. The word Chazon represents a difficult, harsh prophecy. Chazon means I'm about to tell you a very harsh vision I've seen. And so that is the harsh vision which we read leading up to Tisha B'Av, and we will discuss it at greater length, Bezrat Hashem, in the final week of our Zman before Shabbat Dvarim. That's always read in Parsha Dvarim. So in that prophecy, Isaiah says, "Uvefarisechem kapechem," and when you spread out your hands in prayer, "Alim einai mikem," Hashem says, "I'm going to hide my eyes from you. I'm not looking. You're going to pray, and I'm not interested." Why? Yedechem damim maleu. Because those very hands that you spread before me in prayer, well, they're soiled with the blood you've murdered. And so Hashem says, I don't want to hear your prayer. Those hands can't go before me in prayer. And our sages say, from that pasuk we learn that a kohen that killed someone is not allowed to raise his hands and bless the people. So this question comes up. If a Kohen is in a car accident and someone dies, so they killed someone unintentionally, it was by mistake, can they go before the Amud? So this is discussed in Halacha. So Pinchas in our Parsha is concerned. Here he just killed a Jew. He just killed Zimri. Maybe he's not entitled to go before the Amud. I have a friend who lives in the new Jewish quarter, and he was once walking home when two Arab youths attacked him with a knife, and they stabbed him, and he's a powerful guy. He grabbed them both, and one ran away, and he's holding the other one by his neck, and he reaches and he pulls out his gun, and he always walks around with his gun with a bullet inside, cocked, but the safety latch is on, and he's holding the guy who stabbed him by the neck, and he tries to pull down the safety latch, and he has to keep his eye on the guy that he shouldn't kill him, and he can't pull the safety latch down because he couldn't find it with his thumb, and he's holding the gun at the guy, and he keeps trying to find the safety latch with his thumb, and he couldn't find it. He's focusing on the guy, and he keeps doing this, and he can't do it, and he can't take his eyes off the guy because the guy is fighting him. His friends ran away, and by the time he could pull the safety latch, the guy had ran away. Hit him with the gun. Okay, maybe. That's a very dangerous thing to hit him with the gun. Think about it for a second. So he told me, he said to me, he's a Kohen, and he always thought that Hashem saved him from shooting the guy, because he would have killed him had he shot him. He always thought that Hashem saved him, even though halachically, when a person shoots someone in self-defense, or if a person, we have King David's chief general, Benayahu ben Yoyada, was a Kohen. And we see numerous times in the Navi that he killed people. Yes, if you're doing it as part of defending the people of Israel, so then that doesn't disqualify you. And nonetheless, he said, being that there is a big discussion about when yes and when no, and was he still endangering my life at that point or not? The guy was, he told me, he has a stab wound under his arm. He was stabbed. But nonetheless, he says, you see, Hashem saved me from killing someone. Obviously, he wanted me to do Birkat Kohanim without killing someone. But Pinchas was worried. He says, maybe I was disqualified now. Comes Hashem and tells him, no, you avenged my anger against Israel, and so I give you a covenant that from now on, not only are you a Kohen, but high priests are going to come from you, and you're getting a covenant of peace, which we'll discuss in a minute. Yes?
You said that a person about a person that is doing tshuva.
Correct.
It's about understanding.
So a person can do tshuva, right. That's what it brings there too. That's a big discussion. There are two opinions about whether tshuva works for a kohen. Let's say a kohen killed someone and then he did tshuva. So one opinion says that's not good enough. He killed someone, he can no longer do birkat kohanim. The other opinion says tshuva works, he can do birkat kohanim. And it says in Shulchan Aruch that because we want to encourage people to do tshuva, so we go with the opinion that tshuva works and we let him do birkat kohanim. Yes. Because otherwise people will say, well, you see, my tshuva isn't good enough. So we want to help people do tshuva, so we do go with that opinion, yes. I'm sorry, Yaakov Zevi.
What we're saying is that if he's still Jewish blood or Jewish blood or Gentile blood?
I don't think it would make a difference if it was legitimate or illegitimate. I think that's the defining factor.
Okay. So there seems to be this underlying thing that if you kill someone, blood on your hands, and thereby Hashem's not going to listen to your prayer. And then there's also this idea that David and Melech couldn't build a temple, but he uses a very different language, the Mondam Shefachta, which is only used in connection with Korbanot.
Let's see. We'll get to that. It's a good question. Let's see.
Okay. I read a coin that's like someone in the show, because he has a lot of money in the show.
Yafé. Very nice. So, our sages have two opinions about whether Pinchas is in fact the prophet that we call Elijah. When Hashem tells him, I'm giving you the covenant of peace, what is Hashem telling him? So, the ordinary reading would be that he's going to have longevity. Another understanding is he's going to have peace because everyone was upset at him at that time. They knew the halakha that says that if a person is having intimate relations with a non-Jewish woman, then at that moment someone who is a kanai, someone who is a zealot, which doesn't mean he's just a hothead, it means someone who is very holy and worthy of the title zealot. It doesn't just mean that he's going to let out his anger at someone. It means that in everything he does in life, he is very meticulous and careful to the point where he gets the title zealot. It has to be a consistent term. The average person can be a zealot about the neighbor, but what about himself? You know, a zealot means he's consistently zealous about keeping mitzvot with regards to himself. So then he may go and kill the person at the time. So the rabbis of the generation, of Moshe's generation, they felt that that halacha permits killing him, but doesn't obligate killing him. And so they said, maybe it's not such a good idea to do it. Some things the Torah permits, but doesn't recommend. Sometimes the Torah says you're allowed to do it, but the Torah doesn't say you should do it. And so the rabbis of the time thought that this halacha is that it's permissible to do it. And so they were upset at Pinchas. So you're allowed to do it. Great, why'd you do it? They were upset at him. Hashem came to the scene and said, no, he's right. He avenged my anger. Everyone here was quiet. Why were all of you so comfortable sitting quietly when a leader of Israel is desecrating Hashem's name, going with the Midianite woman? And so Hashem says, he covered up for all of you because at least you didn't stand in his way. Meaning, if you didn't stand in Zimri's way when Zimri was doing what was wrong, at least you didn't stand in Pinchas' way when he was doing what was right. So Hashem says, not only won't he be punished for killing a leader of Israel, he will get good wages, he will become a great Kohen, his descendants will be great Kohanim, and I will make a covenant of peace with him, that the angel of death will stay far away from him. And so we find that in the time of the judges, centuries later, Pinchas is still leading the Jewish people. At that time, his zealousness will get him into trouble. And he will refuse to get involved with the issue of Yiftach, Jephthah, and his daughter. And Hashem will take that out on him. Hashem will say, I don't want to talk to you after you behave that way. And he will lose his prophecy. So Pinchas, according to the opinion that he's Elio, so he never passes away. And being that Hashem was upset at him, he got the name Eliyahu HaTishbi, Eliyahu who was returned. Hashem, so to speak, turned him away after what he did with Yiftach's daughter. That's one interpretation as to why he's called Eliyahu HaTishbi. And in the days of Achav, he repented. So Hashem says, he fought for me, I'm going to fight for him. He doesn't have to fight anymore. He could have peace. Our sages say an important line on this. He atoned for the people of Israel with his action. The Medrash Tanchuma says, this teaches us that he who spills the blood of the wicked, it's as though he brought a sacrifice. So guys, don't do this at home, right? That's not doesn't mean we should all stand up and do it. As we discussed last week, Pinchas asked Moshe Rabbeinu before he did it, and Pinchas was worthy of doing it. Now, the Torah then tells us who was the man. In last week's parasha, it didn't identify who this sinner was. It didn't tell us who the man was who publicly went with this woman. In this week's parasha, the Torah tells us, because the Torah is telling us how great Pinchas was, because the man was a leader, and the woman was also a very important woman. She was the daughter of the king, Tzur, the top king of the Midianites. So Pinchas had every reason to be scared. The tribe of Shimon was standing armed to the teeth around their leader's tent when their leader is sinning with this woman. The leader himself is a leader of Israel. The woman is a woman who has a powerful father. And Pinchas says, if this is the halacha, this is what I'm supposed to do, I'm doing it. And he goes and does it, and he risks his life. You know, the Talmud in Tractate Sanhedrin tells us that if Zimri would have noticed him, then Zimri could have turned around and killed him. Even though the halacha permits Pinchas killing Zimri, the halacha also permits Zimri to stand up in self-defense. So Pinchas was risking his life on every front. It says in the Medrash, very interesting lines, it says that Zimri was with her for a very long time inside that tent. And it says that Pinchas stood outside till he felt that Zimri had exhausted himself, because he knew that if he tries to charge him when Zimri still wasn't tired, then he might not live. So although the Torah describes it as a quick act, our sages say that in fact Pinchas stood in line outside that tent and waited patiently for quite a long time because he knew that he has to let Zimri exhaust himself. Yes? No. Right. This is a very special halacha, the Gemara says. Kanoim pogim bo means the Torah allows them to kill him, but he's not. It's not that he's chayav misa. Right? The Torah also, the Talmud says that a second after Zimri would have left Cosby, so then Pinchas would not have been allowed to kill him. He's only allowed to kill him while he's in the act. And so that's another thing that Pinchas had to calculate. Because after the act, you can't hold him accountable by a court down below. No one can touch him. Huh? The pasuk tells us that Zimri was the head of the tribe of Shimon, and the pasuk is embarrassing Shimon. This is where Yaakov Avinu says, "I don't want to be mentioned." But the pasuk is also telling us, strange, his grandfather was so zealous when it came to Dinah, his sister. He says, "How could it be in the house of Jacob?" And yet his own grandson is doing such an act. Rabbi Feinstein, his father, Rav Moshe Feinstein's father, was very zealous about the mitzvah of sitting in the sukkah. And even though it was Russia and it was freezing cold, he sat and slept in the sukkah, and he died of pneumonia after sleeping in the sukkah. So when I heard that story, I thought to myself, for sure Rabbi Feinstein would not sleep in a sukkah when it was too cold. He knows his father died from that. And his children record that Rabbi Feinstein would go great lengths to find ways to heat himself and cover himself and ensure that he does not become sick. But nonetheless, he went very far, way beyond the call of duty, to stay in the sukkah, even in the winter, even when it was very cold, because he said, a mitzvah that my father lost his life for, I have to be more careful. That's a level of piety. I should respect it even more. So it's not what I would have thought. I would have thought, right, when I first heard the story, I said to myself, well, I'm sure his son didn't risk his life after he saw his father die doing the mitzvah. That, you know, that was my first thought. And then I read in the biography that he said the exact opposite. He said, look, if my father lost his life performing this mitzvah, so then obviously he took as much care as he could, and to the point where he thought it was safe, but he went beyond the call of duty. When it was so cold that technically, halachically, he could have said, it's too cold, I don't have to be in the sukkah. He said, no, I got to go further. That's what my father did. And so the parasha tells us that part of the claim against Zimri is, look at your grandfather. He was so zealous against illicit relationships, and you go and do that. Hashem says, I want you to maintain enmity against the Midianites. We have a rule. Haba lehorgecha hashkem lehorgo. Someone's coming to kill you, wake up a little earlier and kill him first. Now, this is an important concept. Seems obvious, right? Sometimes people get a little confused when they do the tshuva process. And they do funny things in the name of Torah. Things that are counterintuitive. What happens if someone wants to smack you? Well, then maybe you should smack them first. What happens if someone wants to tear your garment? Wants to harm you. Maybe you should harm them first. Part of self-defense, part the halacha is, if someone wants to harm you, you're allowed to defend yourself. So that doesn't mean if a guy cuts you in line, you should take out a baseball bat, bash his head, and break his car. He cut me in line. Come on, self-defense. Obviously, there's a certain amount of seichel here. Okay. But there is this concept of self-defense. Our sages say, Hamachti et chaviro. Someone who causes his friend to transgress, gadol mihahogo, it's worse than if he killed them. Because the Mitzrim, they killed us, right? The Egyptians killed Jewish people. And yet the Torah says, don't treat them with disgust, and their third generation may marry into the Jewish people. But Ammon and Moab that caused us to sin, they're not allowed to marry into the Jewish people because of what they did to us. When it comes to Midian, Hashem says, hate them. When you go to war with them, you fight them differently than every other country. Every other country, you have a mitzvah, don't be destructive. You fight them to conquer, you fight them to win, but do not be destructive. That's where we learn the concept of Baal Tashchis. Don't destroy unnecessarily. When it comes to Midian, it says, destroy every city, destroy every tree, fill every source of water. Don't leave anything to flourish in Midianite territory. So that's the idea. Hashem says, fight them with a hatred. Don't just fight them. You have to look at what they did to you and say, I hate the person that caused me to transgress. I was once with a rabbi, and they were serving peaches. And so they offered the rabbi, and he says, no, thank you. And one of his family members said to me, a few years ago, he bit into a peach. And then he saw worms in the peach. And he realized that the slice that he swallowed probably also had worms in it. And ever since then, he can't eat peaches. He's just disgusted with the peach. So I thought to myself, that's interesting. Until I reached this. Yeah, if something caused the person to transgress, so he's supposed to feel a certain feeling towards that. I'm not saying you shouldn't eat peaches. But I'm saying that feeling, hey, that caused me to stumble, that caused me to err, that caused me to transgress, I'm upset at that. There's something to that. Hashem says, what they did to you showed a great hatred. Ordinarily, you protect your princess. And here, they did something unheard of. They said, she's very good looking, so we're going to send her to seduce Jewish men. So that's something which is extraordinary. And so that's why the Torah says, you have to realize the threat and you have to reflect that hatred back to them. Hashem tells us to count the Jewish people. There are three reasons given. One is after 24,000 died, Hashem says, count them again, show them I love them. That's an important concept. It says in Proverbs, Ucheav et ben yirtze. It says, when a person rebukes his child, so it's very important that afterwards he appeases him. Very often we think part of chinuch is to tell the child, why'd you do that? That's wrong. And we could be, we say, hey, I'm educating them. But the pasuk says there's a second part to it. It says, when Hashem rebukes you, don't be upset, because it's like a father who rebukes his child, that after the rebuke he appeases him. So the pasuk assumes that after a father rebukes a child, he takes time to give him more love, to be warm, to make sure that the child feels the love. It's not enough as a parent to give him over the head and sometimes even to punish him. You have to ensure that afterwards the kid knows you love him. And you invest more time and more love after the child has been punished or rebuked. And that's what Hashem does here. He's just punished the Jewish people. 24,000 people died. Think about what that means. How many widows? How many orphans? How many people lost their siblings? 24,000, that's a big number. Hashem says, go count them. Show them I cherish every single one of them. Another understanding is that Moshe Rabbeinu took on the Jewish people and he's concluding his job. So it's like when you're cashiers, at the end of your watch, you count the money you're about to give back. So same thing here, Moshe Rabbeinu, you're finishing your job now. We're reaching the end of Torah, right? So Moshe Rabbeinu takes an accounting before he finishes. And finally, the understanding we mentioned earlier is that we're about to divide the land of Israel, so we have to know how many people each tribe has. The Torah gives us a count of each tribe. We have many insights into the names within the tribes. We have Serach Bas Asher is mentioned. Our sages say she's one of the people that walked into the Garden of Eden alive. You want to hear the other eight? Binyamin, Kilav, David's son, Bitya, the daughter of Paro, Eliezer, Avram's servant, Eved Melech Hakushi, Mashiach, Elio, Yavetz, who asked about Yavetz last Thursday. Some say Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Some say the three sons of Korach. So coming back to here. So Serach, the daughter of Asher. So the Targum says the daughter of his wife. Asher brought her up. And the Chasam Sofer was asked the question, if in a ksuba, a person can write the name of a father who raised the child, even though he's not the biological father. So the Chasam Sofer says that yes, from here, Serach is called the daughter of Asher, even though she wasn't his biological daughter. She was his stepdaughter. And so he raised her in his home. From here we learn that if you raise a child, you're considered the father. And so the Chasam Sofer says, when the child is called up to the Torah, he can be called by the name of the father who raised him. And in the Ksuba, when he gets married, you could write that father's name because he's called the father. So there's a lot to discuss here. I have a question on this halacha. It says in Shulchan Aruch that when you call up a person to the Torah, if they're a convert, if they're a ger, so they're called the son of Avraham Avinu. So what would be something that's very common, if a person, their father's Jewish and their mother's not Jewish, so they have to undergo giyur, right? But who raised them? Their biological father. In halacha, what are they called? Ben Avraham Avinu. So I asked Rav Nevinson, he didn't know the answer. I asked, why do we call such a convert Ben Avraham Avinu? Why don't we go with this response of the Chasam Sofer? Why don't we say, it happens to be his biological father raised him? Let's say you have a ger. He's called Ephraim, okay? And Ephraim's biological father is Shmuel, okay? So Shmuel raised him. Now, when Ephraim becomes 18, 19, 20, Ephraim suddenly says to himself, hey, I'm not Jewish, I have to convert. So he goes to a Jewish court and he converts. Now he wants to get an aliyah to the Torah. So what do we say? He gets an aliyah, it's called Ephraim ben Avram, because a convert is called ben Avram Avinu. So it's true, that's a claim to fame. The fact that a person is called ben Avraham is a term of honor. He's lucky. It's like a convert, according to many opinions, doesn't make the blessing Shelo Asani Goy. Why? Because he's very lucky. He is a self-made man. Every Jew says, Rabban Shalom, thank you. You made me not a non-Jew. But a ger doesn't say that. It's a sign of honor. It's a badge of honor. I can't say that. Hashem, the ger, so to speak, says, Hashem did make me a goy, and I made myself a Jew. Every Jew that says Shelo Asani Goy, he's saying, thank you, Hashem, you did that for me. But a ger, so to speak, when he omits that blessing, what he's saying is, you didn't do that for me, I did that for me. It's a badge of honor. Okay, other opinions say that a ger can say Shelo Asani Goy. But two opinions in halacha. But coming back to here. So when a ger is called up to the Torah, Ben Avraham Avinu, that's a badge of honor. I am a great, 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 great grandson of Avraham Avinu. Got a long way to connect to Avraham Avinu, but the ger is a direct son. It's a badge of honor. I understand that. But let's say the ger says, I want to be called Ephraim ben Shmuel to the Torah. So the halacha says that we generally don't recommend it because it's not his biological, halachically it's not his father. And I asked, but if he raised him, and the Chassam Sofer says that someone who raised you, you can be called after him when you go up to the Torah or in the Ksuba. So then why is this any different? That was my question. And I, Rav Neventzel didn't know an answer. I don't know the answer, but that's the way we go. That's our custom. And if he did raise him as a Jew? You're saying he didn't do that part of raising him. I hear. I have to think about it. I'm saying the Talmud actually proves it from the mother. One of Saul's daughters raised the other one's children, and the children are named after her. One of King David's wives, whatever. But I don't know. I don't know. It's a good point. Maybe you're right. Yeah. People are waiting. Give me 1 second. Yes.
What about Get Hatam, who was raised as a Jew, but they didn't take an obligation, Kabbalah's mitzvot. They didn't take, but they were raised as Jews by the adoptive father.
Again, the custom is we call them Ben Avraham. That's the custom. Again, if a ger says, I'm very uncomfortable and I want to be called like this, I understand. But still, that's the custom. We call him Ben Avraham. I don't know why that's the custom. I'm saying, based on this Chatam Sofer, I don't know why we wouldn't do that. Maybe Yaakov's answer is correct. I hear that. I don't know. I have to think about it. Maybe. Yeah.
Why is it Ben Avraham if it's on Israel? We don't look at Avraham as a Jew, right?
Ava mongo im netaticha. Chazal understood the blessing to Avraham of Ava mongoim. Is that many nations will be able to become your children through conversion. And Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov are the fathers of our nation. En korin avot el ha-shlosha. It says in the Tosefta and Tractate Brachos that the fathers of the people of Israel are Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Ah, they're not Jewish. They're still the fathers of the people of Israel. Yes.
Personally, of course, I would like to be called up to the Torah as Ben Avraham, but I want to go as Reuven Ben Aaron after my father, because I love my father, and I feel without him I wouldn't be able to get to this step. I want to give him the respect that he raised me as my father. Now, this is someone who raised you. This is someone who pushed you in the right path. No matter if this was your path then, and this is your path now. This is not. This is something. that you needed this to be able to get to this step. If so, I personally, this is something that anyone can take on two ends of the spectrum, but as you were saying, they should have at least a choice, but if it's a real issue, then, then it's an issue. But in my personal opinion, I would rather go by Ruben Ben Aaron, but it doesn't bother me going by Ruben Ben Avraham.
No, I'm saying, because I understand that, and that the term in the Gemara is kol ha-megadelet ben chavero, whoever raises someone else's son, ki'ilu yelado. It's as though they gave birth to them. So I just question, they raised them. Back to our parasha. It happens to be a big discussion in halacha, because the questions revolve around situations where a person passes away and there's a question of inheritance. And the kids say, he's not a biological kid, he doesn't inherit our father. And the kid says, I was called up to the Torah as the son of. And the Chasam Sofer says, well, that's not a proof that you're the son of. He raised you. But if everyone's saying you're adopted, so with all due respect, you're not a biological kid if we have facts to the contrary. So it happens to be a big discussion in halacha the other way, meaning where the kid is arguing, I'm his biological son, give me a piece of inheritance, and they have proof that runs contrary to that. And there are many responses. This has been issues, ongoing issues. It's an interesting question, do you tell a child, when do you tell a child they're adopted? You run into very difficult issues, because a child shouldn't end up marrying their sister if you don't tell a child they're adopted. This has become a greater issue today with in vitro fertilization. You have situations where people take donor sperm and they don't even know who the father is, and the father could have donated sperm, to a sperm bank and impregnated 500 women. And now the kid has to make sure they're not marrying their sister. Children don't necessarily know where they came from. The parents don't bother telling the kid. So this issue has ramifications to present day as well. So the land is divided. Larger tribes get larger portions, smaller tribes get smaller portions. We count the people based on the generation that left Egypt. So they went back to the genealogy to calculate how many people each tribe had when they left Egypt. The way they divided the portions was Eliezer was now the high priest, right? Pinchas' father, Eliezer, the son of Aaron, was the Kohen Gadol. He wore his priestly garments. All of Israel stood there, and they had lots. And in one box, they had the different portions of the land of Israel. And in another box, they had the names of the tribe. And Eliezer said, I'm now going to pick out the tribe of Zebulun, and the territory that they should receive is, and he would describe it, and then he'd stick his hand into the lots and pull out a lot. And out came the tribe of Zebulun, and out came their lot. And this is what he did with each tribe. This was a way of showing the tribes that this was all ordained by Hashem. So the Pasuk tells us that at this point, when they were dividing the land of Israel, there were no men left from the generation that left Egypt. All the men had died. And our sages quickly point out, the women were still around. That's the Medrash we saw last week, that when Aaron was told that he and Moshe would die, Aaron felt like saying, Ribon Shel, my mother's going to enter the land of Israel without any kids? Miriam died, me and Moshe are going to die, my mother's going to enter all alone? Yeah, his mother was still alive. Yocheved was still alive. The women, you had a bunch of old ladies entering the land of Israel. You had maybe a million old ladies, widows. The daughters of Tzlafchat step forward, and they are from the tribe of Menashe ben Yosef. And the Torah points this out to tell us that they came from a tribe that loves the land of Israel. Yosef is the first to go forward and tell his children, make sure to bring me to the land of Israel. And that's why the Torah tells us they were descendants of that tzaddik Yosef. And it's telling us that from Yosef till them, all of them were tzaddikim. And they were scared that maybe Moshe would think their father died as part of Korach's gang. So they said, our father wasn't a part of that. He did his own sins and he died. And, why did they mention he did his own sins? So one understanding is they were explaining why he didn't have sons. That that's considered a punishment, not having sons to take over his lot. It could be that this is a source for what we say in Slichot, where we say, Aval anachnu v'avotenu chatanu, we and our fathers transgressed. A child is allowed to say, my father also transgressed, when it's relevant to moving his father forward. So our sages say that Moshe knew the answer, and yet he said, let's ask Hashem. One Midrash says that they came to one court, the court said, we don't know, they passed it on to the next court said, we don't know, and they kept passing it up, until all the courts came before Moshe Rabbeinu, and Moshe Rabbeinu said, if I answer them, so I'm going to take all this pride, no one knew, everyone came to ask me, and I'm going to answer? So Moshe said, let's ask Hashem. So he wanted to show we're all bound to Hashem. It was a way of giving all that honor that he would have received had he given the answer and giving it to Hashem. So that's why he asked Hashem. Others say that Moshe Rabbeinu was scared that people would think that Moshe was biased. Moshe said, why did they go to all these other courts? Because they were scared that I'm biased against their father. That's why they come and they say our father wasn't part of Korach's gang. They were scared Moshe had it in for their father. So Moshe said, let's ask Hashem. Moshe didn't want a situation where he'd answer off the cuff and they'd think that he answered out of his bias. He saw they were concerned. And here we see a sensitivity. We see this over and over again in Tanakh. If you think people suspect you, so make sure to come clean. It says when Moshe did all his service in the temple, he would wear a cloak that had no hem. It was made of simple material without a hem and without pockets. So that whenever Moshe went into the temple, into the Mishkan, no one could think he took some gold and silver and pocketed it. So Moshe, come on. He's not interested in gold and silver, but he knows other people might think he is. So Moshe purposely wore clothing that he couldn't hide anything in. Everyone knew. He walked in, he walked out clean, nothing with him. No bag, no pocket, nothing. So we have the mitzvah of inheritance. And all the details of inheritance come through women. And this is a double-edged sword. Why does it come through women? Because death came through women, right? Eve gave Adam to eat from the fruit. So that's why all the mitzvahs of inheritance, the halachos stem from women asking the question. And also, the whole idea of inheriting the land of Israel, which is what they asked, this shows us another concept, that women are stronger than men in their love of the land of Israel. Historically, women were more faithful to Hashem, and women were more faithful to the land of Israel than the men were, more dedicated. And so that's why this goes through women also. Moshe is told, you can go up the mountain and see the land of Israel. And the commentaries point out, Bilam, when he looks at something, he can impart curses on things when he looks at them. When Moshe looks at things, it imparts blessing. And that's why Moshe goes to see the land of Israel. When Moshe hears that Hashem says, even a daughter inherits her father's lot, and then Hashem tells Moshe, you're going to pass away. So Moshe says, who's going to take over? And Moshe's hope was, who would take over? His own children. And Hashem says, Yeshua was so careful to learn from you all the time, Yeshua takes over. So appoint Yeshua as your leader instead. Put your hand on him. And Moshe puts both hands on Yeshua. That's the idea of smicha. He puts both hands on him and he blesses him and he appoints him the next leader. So Hashem said, put one hand. Moshe put both hands. Moshe shows, I love him and with the whole heart, I want him to be the next leader. But what did Moshe really want beforehand? He wanted his own kids. So we see on the one hand, a teacher loves a student and he wants a student to succeed. On the other hand, he's still a parent. He still wants his kids to succeed. The two don't conflict. But you see, he did try to see how he could get his children to have the leadership. Once Hashem said, give it to your students, he gave it to a student with the whole heart. He did more than Hashem asked him for. And this is, again, a reflection of Moshe being the opposite of Bilam. Bilam has an evil eye. Bilam always tries to take for himself. And when Moshe gives, he gives with a good heart. He gives with a good eye. He gives with both hands. Yes?
How come both of Moshe's sons, not only do they give leadership, but they're not ever talked about figures in Jewish history? Do they not do anything of substance? Or they just, we never speak about them realistically ever. They're not part of any of the stories in Tanakh, really. Especially as adults, at least.
So our sages say that in general it's very hard for the children of Talmidei Chachamim to be Talmidei Chachamim, because Hashem doesn't want people to think you have to be the son of someone big in order to become someone big. So Hashem makes it so on purpose that people's children, when they're Talmidei Chachamim, they have it much harder to get there. But more than that, I don't know. It definitely seems from this medrash that they were worthy. Moshe didn't think my sons who are bums should be the leaders. Obviously, they were high up there. They were high ranking. But Yoshua was more high ranking because he worked so hard. Because he worked so hard. There's a fascinating Gemara in Nedarim. The Gemara says that as much as Moshe learned, he didn't get it. He couldn't remember his learning until Hashem blessed him. Maybe leave it open, Yehuda. Thank you. Until Hashem blessed him, and because of the blessing, he was able to retain his learning. We see even Moshe had a hard time remembering his learning. Okay, so Moshe asks for a leader who will lead them to war. When we went to war against Sihon and Og, Moshe led the way. When Joshua is standing outside the camp and he sees a man with his sword stretched out, Joshua walks up to him. David led the people to war. Our leaders led the way to war, historically. And this was part of the responsibility of a leader. When Yoshua sends the people to fight a small city of Ai, and he does not lead them to war, they lose. Then he turns to Hashem and says, what's going on here? And Hashem says, I said a leader is responsible to lead to war. What were you doing sending people out to battle and you weren't with them? Of course they didn't succeed. So that's the rule Hashem tells Moshe. Moshe asks, I want a leader who will lead them. And Hashem says, I'm giving you a leader who will lead. He has to walk in front of them. So Moshe blesses Yoshua and he appoints him as leader so that everyone knows that he is the leader. When we speak about the sacrifices, so on the sacrifice of Rosh Chodesh, it says, Chatat Lashem, a chata sacrifice for Hashem. And our sages ask, why on that sacrifice does it say for Hashem? So our sages say a complicated line. They say, Hashem says, bring an atonement for me. Because when at creation I created the sun and the moon as two great luminaries, and then the moon said, you can't have two carrying one crown, we can't both be the great luminaries. So Hashem said to the moon, okay, go and minimize yourself. And so Hashem says, the first punishment in the world was given to the moon, I want atonement for the punishment I gave to the moon. What does that mean? Hashem gave the punishment. What does he need atonement for? So, Rav Herschel Schachter explained this Gemara. He said, it's Hashem telling us that he created a world where his divine wisdom dictated that there would be suffering. We don't understand it. Why does the world have to have lacking? Why did the moon have to be diminished? Hashem could do everything, so there doesn't have to be punishment in the world. So Hashem says, I want to show humanity on some level that, so to speak, I share in their pain when they see a world that they don't exactly have a good answer for, why there has to be a diminishment of the moon. Why does there have to be pain, suffering, lacking in the world? So Hashem says, the first time I did something in the world that reflected punishment, that reflected pain, was diminishing the moon. Bring a sacrifice that will be, so to speak, for me, that will tell the people, I share your pain. I did it, and I share your pain in that I did it. Once a month. And we have a mitzvah that once a month we go out and bless the new moon. What are we blessing? So let's analyze that blessing. What we're saying is, blessed are you, Hashem, who in his speech, Hashem, you created the expansive, the universe. all the armies, all the constellations of heaven. You created a statute, a set system, where they have to work within that system, and they grow larger and smaller. The moon, every month, is renewed, and all the constellations function within that system happily. So the stress of that blessing is, po elemet, Hashem, you do honest, truthful things. Shepulato emet, your actions are true. Velalvana amar shetitchadesh, and you told the moon to have a renaissance, to be renewed every month. What are we saying in Kiddush Levana? We're saying we're looking at this world where things sometimes are not perfect. Sometimes you have something that's diminished. You have a moon. It disappears for 24 hours. And yet we look at it and we bless Hashem and we say, blessed are you Hashem who gives renaissance. You could look at it and say, Hashem, why do you diminish things? Hashem, why does the world have to lack a moon for 24 hours? No, we look at it and we bless. And the greatness of the blessing of the moon is that the Jewish people are accepting the way Hashem runs the world with happiness. And that's why in the month of Av and in the month of Tishrei, many people have the custom that they don't bless the moon till after Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, so that you could be calm, you could be happy, because the essence of the blessing is that I'm happy, that I'm willing to accept it. It's Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shamayim. I'm saying, Ribon Sholem, I live in your world. I have questions. I see a world where you made things lack, and I can see the good in it. And even though I don't have all the answers, I can bless you over the renaissance and the renewal that you implanted in the world, which is reflected first and foremost by the moon. So we make that blessing every month. Hashem says in our parasha, bring a sacrifice. Show them that I care. Even though I've created this world this way, on some level they should see I care. That's the sacrifice of the Rosh Chodesh, the Chatas, and to some degree, that's probably what we're saying in the blessing on the new moon. Yes?
Now that we know that the moon actually does not diminish in size, that it's just here, it's not growing small. The moon is not large.
That's not the point, that's the wording. We mean in terms of the moon vis-a-vis us. You know, I travel to Kochav Yaakov every night. When there's a full moon, I can see if anyone's throwing rocks at me. You literally, you have a tremendous spotlight out there. You see. And when the moon is diminished, so you don't see. We don't appreciate its impact. I'm telling you because I learned to appreciate it only in that ride from here to Kochav Yaakov where I need that moonlight. Today, we don't appreciate it. Chazal worded it that way, but that's not the point. If you learn Chazal, the term that Chazal uses, Chaf Dalet Shai Michse Sihara. The moon is covered for 24 hours. They didn't think it disappeared. They knew more revealed, less revealed. Even in our parsha, it says Hashem tells Moshe, place some of your glory on him. So our sages said, some of your glory, not all of your glory. Your glory. Moshe reflects the sun, and Moshe's face was like the sun. Joshua's face was like the moon. Just as the moon reflects the light of the sun. So Chazal spoke about that idea, that the moon reflects the sun. Okay. Whenever we would bring the Tamid sacrifice, every morning and every night, so when we'd bring the sacrifice in the morning, we would face the west, and our backs were to the east. And at night, we would face the east, and our backs were to the west. Part of what we're declaring when we bring the sacrifice morning and night is that we're not pagans, we don't worship the sun. We face Hashem and our backs are to the sun when we bring the sacrifices. The sacrifice of Rosh Chodesh is a sa'ir, is a goat. Every month, the months represent the 12 tribes, and the sacrifice reflects that we want atonement for that baseless hatred that existed between the brothers. And so we bring a goat every month. It used to be when Hashem first took the Jews out of Egypt, we were supposed to have a holiday every Rosh Chodesh. Every month we discussed last week corresponds to a different tribe. Remember we said, there's a different stone, there's a different part of the land of Israel, there's a different color on the flag, there's a different talis, there are different strengths, there's a different nusach of tefillah. Remember we discussed the different strengths of each tribe, their different attributes, and so each month and each sign in the zodiac represents that strength of that tribe. And so there was supposed to be a holiday each month for each tribe. when they sinned with the golden calf. We lost that holiday. Only the women who did not sin, they retained that. That's why many women won't do laundry on Rosh Chodesh, etc. We are beginning the three prophecies of destruction. And after Tisha B'Av, we'll have seven prophecies of comfort. The three prophecies are divided corresponding to three destructions we had. There was the destruction of the first temple that led us to Babylon. There was the destruction of the northern ten tribe, which was probably the greatest Holocaust in Jewish history. And then there's the current exile we're in. Those are the three themes we're talking about. And this corresponds also to the three stages of exile. You first had Reuven, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. The eastern side of the Jordan was exiled. Then you had the northern tribe, Zvulun and Naphtali, and then the remainder of the ten tribes. So the exile was divided into three sections. And then the exile of Judea was also divided into three components. First you had the exile under the king Jehoiakim, and then you had the exile under the king Jehoiachin, and finally you had the destruction of the first temple and the king Tzidkiyahu. And in the second temple, we also had three stages to the destruction. First, Adrian came and conquered everything and exiled people. And then Apustumus came and conquered everyone and burnt the Sefer Torah. And finally, Titus came and destroyed everything and exiled everyone. In the prophecy we'll read this week, it's the beginning of Jeremiah. The prophet Jeremiah is going to see a shakade. Shakade is a tree of almonds. It is the first tree to blossom. And Hashem, it says, was shoked. Shaked also means to be swift. Hashem was swift to bring the exile, because had we stayed a little bit longer in the land of Israel, we wouldn't have been deserving of redemption. So Hashem said, let me exile them before they sin anymore. Jeremiah was a descendant of Rahav. Rahav was a woman of ill repute. When Jeremiah the Kohen came to rebuke the people of Israel, people mocked him. They said, your grandmother, you know what she was? People would tell Jeremiah that. And that's why the Pasuk reminds us that he was a descendant of Chilkiyahu. He was a Kohen. And when he sees the stick of an almond tree, where do we have that 2-3 weeks ago in the Parsha? Where did we have an almond stick? The Kohen Gadol, the staff of Aaron. And the almond tree takes 21 days from the time it blossoms to the time the fruit reach a ripening, what's called chanata, and that corresponds to the 21 days we are in now, 21 days from Shiva Asar B'Tammuz to Tisha B'Av. 21 days is 3 weeks, three sets of seven. It says the people of Israel had enough food for 21 years had they not had hatred, baseless hatred between them. When they burnt down their own storage houses, the Romans were able to take them over. Had we not had baseless hatred, we could have withstood those 21 years which correspond to these 21 days, and then the Romans couldn't have taken us down. Our strength is in the threesome, in the unity, the ability to unite the different factions of Israel. When we break up, that's when we fall apart, and that's what brought about the destruction. And that's why the destruction is described with the branch of an almond, which also reflects those 21 days and 21 years. Shabbat Shalom. This